2003, just in time to, colleagues, now that we've got everybody gathered, to answer a call of the House.
Oh, yeah.
So I will tell those who are here in the audience, as well as the members, the plan is to just take the bills as they are on the agenda. There is no introduction of speaker-approved bills, measure drafting requests, nor consideration of proposed amendments to House rules. So we'll begin as soon as we are finished with these votes, come down for SJR 12. And we'll go from there. But for now, we are in recess.
Yeah, well.
of the session justifiable to take out tax reform, as we must do it to fulfill our legislative and constitutional responsibilities. Thank you.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the motion.
To the motion.
Wow. I guess in the process of this, Mr. Speaker, I'm probably going to impugn the character of a whole lot of people here. When I first debated running for the legislature, my wife paraphrased to me a quote from Mark Twain. Supposing you were an idiot. Supposing you were a member of the Oregon legislature. But I repeat myself. This is my fourth session. I certainly don't have the 10-year experience that the good representative from West Lynn has. I would hope, if my wife's comments were correct, that I would be just a tad brighter than the good representative from West Lynn, though I know that would be very difficult, given her comments, and rise to the occasion and get out of a body where that were true. The first year that I was here, the good senator from Canby, who now is the representative from West Lynn's counterpart on the Senate side, will remember. I was a member of the caucus on the other side of the room at that time. And one of the agendas was tax reform. And some of us in our naivete, perhaps as freshmen, thought that we might be able to make a difference and implement some type of tax reform. It's four sessions now. And colleagues, this is the first time this topic has had serious discussion in this body. The representative from Tigard said, if not now, when? Going to wait for another four sessions? The one thing I hear at home, and that, like all of you, I don't have too many people who love taxes, but the one thing that I hear loud and clear, conservatives and liberals, Democrats, independents, and Republicans, is that the tax system in the state is broken and needs to be reformed. The purpose here is not to cram down some type of resolution. The purpose is to have a group of us, maybe according Mark Twain is right, then maybe it is the wrong group, but a group of us, which probably will conclude some fairly liberals, given where the Senate will come from on this, probably will conclude some rather conservatives, given where the House is at on this. But colleagues, that's what our state is made up of, is some liberals and some conservatives. We represent them, and that's the type of dialogue we need to have in a meaningful discussion about tax reform. Who better than the members of the legislature who are elected to represent the people of this state to debate this topic. I don't believe the same way all of you do. I don't agree with a lot of the things that you do, and I know you don't agree with a lot of the things that I do in this body.
Representative Shoffler yields.
But when it comes to making hard decisions, I'm sorry, but I have a lot of confidence in you. I have confidence that you will do down here at this level, at the heart level, what you think is right. My heart may disagree. That's okay. Not credible. How in the world did we ever get elected? Did we take the most incredible people in our districts? And that's how we got elected? I believe, in spite of what we hear on some of the talk show radio and in some of the print media, that you are viewed in your communities as leaders. I believe you are respected by many of your citizens. And I believe they will respect what you do. I've answered a whole ton of emails, some who agreed with us and some who disagreed with us on the infamous bill, or famous bill, as the case may be, that passed this body having to do with revenue a little while ago. Even those who, many of those who violently disagreed with how I voted, and there were one or two in my district who did that, wrote back on my emails and basically thanked me for taking the hard decision and for doing what I felt was right, even if they didn't agree with it. Today is the day to stand up for Oregon. Today is the time. It is now. We can't wait forever to do tax reform in this state. Probably no big deal for me, but I don't want to leave my grandchildren with a state that has a broken tax system like we have. I want to leave my grandchildren with a better place to live in the state of Oregon. Please, colleagues, regardless of everything else you have on your agenda on this, seriously consider this and pass this motion. Thank you.
Representative Kitzer in the privilege queue, for what purpose do you wish to be recognized?
Defeat the motion.
Mr. Speaker, not having realized that I was guilty of legislative malpractice, I would withdraw my motion to postpone indefinitely.
Representative Kitts, I'll take that as a motion to withdraw the motion to postpone indefinitely. Since the motion is in possession of the body, it does take a concurrence of the members. We'll do this by voice vote. Those in favor of Representative Kitts' motion to withdraw his motion to postpone indefinitely will say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carries. The motion to withdraw to postpone indefinitely is withdrawn. Colleagues, that releases us from the queue. The Rules Committee may resume their meetings, and we are back to the queue that we had before we went to the motion to postpone indefinitely. This now is further discussion on the motion to concur in the Senate amendments. Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the motion.
To the motion, thank you. First, I'd like to thank the Speaker for allowing this discussion to go forward. It takes great leadership on the part of someone to allow things of this magnitude to happen on the last day of the session. I wonder about those among us who fear tax reform. I wonder why they fear it. And I'm also sorry some people in this chamber think that they have no credibility. That's not what my constituents tell me that they think about us. The House Revenue Committee completed 2 weeks of intense public hearings on tax reform. The hearings were universally hailed as a positive, open process called democracy in the raw. Responding to the current budget shortfall, Republicans and Democrats on the committee took the opportunity to hear testimony on possible solutions. We heard from 128 witnesses, including educators, economists, business leaders, a former governor, special interest groups, and concerned citizens. They delivered 756 pages of exhibits during 21 hours of testimony. And if those witnesses are representative of a majority of Oregonians, then this committee's work has just begun. Two quotes stand out as a summary of the many hours of hearings. First, we all agree that we can't fund everything and that waste still exists in state government. But what we need to agree on is what should be funded.
House Committee on Rules and Public Affairs is back in order, and A little different than what I had originally stated. We are going out of order of the agenda in that the first bill we'll take a look at is Senate Bill 928. So let's open up a work session on Senate Bill 928. Senator Perioli, can you explain the bill, please?
Mr. Chairman, I can. First of all, I'd like to thank the committee for the courtesy of bringing me up. In the batting order of the building, the courtesy is extended to representatives and senators who obviously and clearly have other duties in other parts of the building, and obviously that is not the case with me, since I am a member of the body who has sine died. So I really appreciate being able to come before the body. Mr. Chairman, the bill before you has been a couple of years in the making. It is an attempt and a recognition. The recognition essentially started with State Treasurer Randall Edwards, who was very discomforted by his consideration of the navigability petition on the Sandy River. And I think he came to the realization that many of us have, that navigability is a traumatic process that we put people through, and it results in a disassociation between landowners and their state government. And in the case of the Sandy River that was declared navigable, it's a pretty emotionally traumatic experience to have the state claim property that may have been in families for 150 years since statehood. As a result of that, State Treasurer Edwards telegraphed his desire to try to find a different alternative to navigability, one that focuses on conflict resolution by developing recreation management planning. What's proposed in this bill is the result of public hearings that were conducted in many different venues throughout the state. And what is proposed is a compromise that is supported by landowners by a 2-to-1 margin on the John Day River and by land use rights organizations, Cattlemen Association, Farm Bureau, and others, that essentially offers an opportunity to create a management template for the John Day River by developing a recreation management plan that would bring together recreationists, landowners, and the county government and other jurisdictional organizations to work on a recreation management plan and to put that plan into place. The objective of that plan is to reduce conflict and to create a management template that could be used in other rivers. So the work here will essentially develop a template that might be used elsewhere. This approach meets with the governor's requirements that he laid out about navigability. One, that it had to be high water to high water mark. Two, that it had to be an opportunity that wasn't just available only to the John Day River, but could be used as a demonstration project for building this template. The bill before you embodies some issues that were compromised on, and I think those compromises are really critical. The first is that this bill goes into effect on passage, but the bank-to-bank access is delayed until January 1st, 2004. And the portions of the bill that immediately go into effect are the opportunity to bring together the groups under the auspices of the Parks and Recreation Department to create the management plan. And this is the compromise, the final compromise, that brought support for the bill. We all know that under the navigability issue, that rivers are highways forever free for access. That's what happens under the navigability declaration. But even on free highways, there are speed limits and rules to the road, rules for using the road, when to yield, where to travel, etc. And you have a law enforcement presence. You even have to have a license to use the highways, even though they are free for everyone to use. We thought that delaying the implementation of the public access would help because it gives people a chance to develop the rules of the road. And that way this group, this committee of landowners and recreationists and other publics wouldn't always be just chasing spot fires up and down the river trying to get ahead of conflict, when in fact they need to just be allowed to develop the recreation plan. So that was the major change in the bill that brought many folks to the table. The time to develop the rules of conduct for the river recreation, then the public access following shortly thereafter. The bill does several things. It allows public access bank to bank. It provides significant protections for landowners. It allows the public to use the river for boating, angling, wading, or swimming, even hunting, as long as it's for river-associated hunting and for waterfowl. What is prevented on these lands is open fires, disposal of human waste, overnight camping, and reckless discharge of firearms. The protections for the landowners are also clear. Landowners are protected from liability for any environmental damage caused by recreational use to habitat, fish or wildlife, or water quality, and would be compensated for any property damage that's specifically associated with recreation use. What is also offered under this is protections for recreationists, who would now be able to clearly identify where they may travel, where they may anchor, where they may fish, where they may swim, where they may stand, where they may beach their watercraft, and where they may recreate. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I believe that this is an historic compromise between landowners and recreational users who have agreed that this bill should go forward. And we hope that this committee will take a positive action here today. Most landowners, when asked, give permission for recreational use on the river. That's a fact. Most recreationists are wonderfully well behaved when they use the rivers. These are the people who gain by this bill. I believe that this is an absolutely necessary alternative to the process of navigability, which has proven to be expensive and litigious and controversial and traumatic. So we hope that this new tool will be available for the folks on the John Day. It goes into effect immediately. We have a four-year sunset on this. We'll put the plan in effect, make a report to the legislature after a two-year period. The nice part about this is that the Parks and Recreation Department has agreed to facilitate the recreation management plan. They will essentially eat that. We don't need additional appropriation to do that. Agencies agreed to go to the Legislative Emergency Board and ask for additional limitation for dollars they've already identified to do this plan. So there's no fiscal on the effect or impact on this budget. So this, we believe this is ready to go, and it's a good compromise. Okay. I stand ready to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Senator, for that explanation. That's a very good one. As I understand it, this bill leaves open the issue of navigability.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Barnhart, no one loses the position that they currently hold with this bill. Navigability is suspended during the period of time that the recreation management plan is being developed and implemented, and through the period of reporting back to the legislature and through the sunset date. If the recreation management plan cannot be accomplished or fails to deliver the reduction of conflict that's designed, then the parties have all the rights that they would have under navigability.
Thank you very much.
Representative Berger.
Thank you. Since the period, this is a very controversial subject.
Yes, ma'am.
And so, you know, I want to be really sure as we move forward here what your vision is and a little bit of background. This bill comes with much discussion, does it? Second part of the question is, do you envision using just John Day so that it can be used as a role model or a template for other rivers in Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, to the two questions, I can't imagine another issue that has had more public testimony in the past 6 years. But specifically to this particular bill and the precursors to this bill, the various versions, this has been heard in public hearings in Monument, in different areas of the state. The state treasurer actually did quite an extensive road trip vetting this concept of a recreation management plan. Initially, this would have covered several rivers. It was narrowed in scope and focus to only rivers that are currently under petition for navigability. And among those, the John Day is the closest to being released by the State Land Board for the determination of navigability. In point of fact, the Land Board has delayed action twice on the John Day River in anticipation of the creation of this plan. The governor's caveat for support of this bill is that it not be specific to the John Day, that it be used as a laboratory to find out whether or not Oregonians can plan a recreation model that reduces conflict between recreational users and landowners. And those issues are very specific, the ones that we've identified so far. It's sanitation. It's access to the river for put in and take out. It's signage. It's law enforcement and emergency services. You know, those are the issues that continuously come to the surface when you talk about services to the public that they need for recreation use and protection for the landowner from unsanitary practices and vandalism and so forth. So what we're hoping for is by bringing the jurisdictions that actually provide the emergency services to the table, along with landowners who own the land and recreationists who need the access and want the access, and the federal and state agencies that also have management authority in the river corridor, all of the responsible parties will be at the table. We can talk about these issues, and with I believe the diligence that we've shown so far that gets us to this place and the goodwill of people that want a solution, I believe we can craft a recreation management plan that will work on the John Day and elsewhere. And I certainly, just to continue, intend not to leave this an orphan plan from this building. I intend to be involved with others that care deeply about the success of this plan to make sure it's successful.
Further questions?
I have a question.
Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you. On page 3, line 26, we're talking about compensation. And I just would like to have clarified, landowners that do suffer property damage are eligible for compensation to restore or replace property lost or damaged. And it says that this compensation, it comes from the State Parks and Recreation Department. Is there no way also for to be able to go after the people that actually caused the damage?
Mr. Chairman, to Representative Moniz Anderson, absolutely. People are not free to vandalize or destroy private property without having personal civil liability. But very often it's difficult to trace any individual. Currently, there's simply a lot of anonymity on the river. And that's one of the things that the Recreation Management Plan may deal with, is perhaps a licensing process or an identification process. Not so odious that people are discouraged from using the river, but so in fact there can be some connection between personal responsibility and observed behavior. But we often hear stories of people that go to a recreation or to a site that there's been recreationists and find pumps that have been vandalized and things shot up or fire started. And if you simply cannot connect that with an individual for a personal liability, there should be a way to compensate those people for the damage to their property.
I guess what I would like to know is under the Sandy River that now has become navigable, when a river becomes navigable, are they able to get compensation for damage done, or is this something new?
Mr. Chairman, to represent Moniz Anderson, this would be the first time, essentially, there's been an opportunity to address these issues. So, the funding mechanism cannot just be Parks and Recreation. It's anticipated that this working group would also figure out how we compensate and how we pay these damages off. So there is a lot of heavy lifting to do that's left for this group, and compensation is going to be one of the topics on the table.
Okay. Well, and just one follow-up. Has there been a fiscal done for this then, or is this just setting up the advisory but the compensation type thing is not an issue?
Mr. Chairman, there has been a fiscal that has been prepared. The fiscal showed that the actual cost of developing the plan was about $60,000 to $70,000. The Minister of Parks and Recreation Department identified dollars in order to facilitate the plan within their resource base. They're going to go to the Legislative E-Board and ask for an increase in limitation to account for those dollars. What isn't in the bill is any kind of fee structure or any kind of cost estimate of what that would be. And we really need to get the management plan on paper and find out what the law enforcement presence is determined to be in terms of the need of the community, what the signage needs are, what the access points were taken and put out, how the sanitation system is going to work. That will create a much better idea of what the long-term fiscal requirements are. And at that point, we're going to start looking at what mechanisms the state has to pay for this. And it could be some sort of a license structure or fee structure.
All right. Seeing no one further, I appreciate your testimony.
Chairman, to every member of the committee, thank you very much for consideration. I understand you're under tremendous pressure and opportunity to present this bill. It's very much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Backlund, can you move this to the floor, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 928 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Backlund moves Senate Bill 928 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Call the roll.
Representative
Backlund.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Both
aye.
Representative Clark.
Aye.
Representative
Berger. Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. And Carrier? I'll carry this bill. And Senate Bill 928 then moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. That closes the work session on Senate Bill 928, and now we return to the top of the agenda to SJR 12A. We'll open up a work session on SJR 12 and ask Sandy Flicker to come forward and explain this resolution.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I represent the Oregon Rural Electric Co-op Association, and here today as well is Cindy Roberts, who represents Consumers Power in Philomath and Central Electric Co-op in the Bend area in Redmond, who would be available if there were any questions. Thank you very, very much for the opportunity to come before you and speak to SJR 12. I will not have lengthy comments at all, but there are a few things I would like to say. I have been before this committee before talking about the issue of the possibility of the city of Portland becoming a municipal electric utility. I have shared with you our concerns regarding that. The electric co-ops started getting involved in this issue long before actually even the city of Portland was involved, and that's when there was a concept called Willamette Valley Power, and they were looking at forming a regional utility to possibly purchase PGE service territory. And at that time, we began becoming very concerned about the power supply issue in the Northwest if that were to happen. We've worked with several folks trying to find out what the possibilities might be should that happen, and I'll be very clear to tell you that we don't know. Bonneville Power supplies 100% of the power to the consumer-owned utilities in Oregon and in the Northwest, period. They have a limited supply. They are very much impacted by water conditions, and they are very much impacted by fish programs, and that limits their supply. So it only stands to reason that the pot is only so big. And therefore, you add a large new utility purchasing power from Bonneville out of that pot, and it has an impact. Because then Bonneville has to go to the market, because they have to fulfill the requirements of preference customers, and therefore that could raise the cost to all the other preference customers, and those are electric co-ops. That may or may not happen. There will be a long regional process that will deal with how Bonneville deals with new loads. I can't tell you for sure, nor can really anybody else. Even Steve Wright, the administrator of the Bonneville Power Administration, cannot tell you what the impact will be for sure. But we know what the impact could be because we've gone down that road. When we got into this last contract period, there was political pressure that time from the Clinton administration on Bonneville to sell power to the direct service industries, the aluminum companies. And they did. They oversold their system by 3,300 megawatts. We got a 46% rate increase. Now, granted, there was a very high market at the time, but they had to go to the market because they had to serve that load because of the political pressure. So this can be a very political issue. Again, there will be a very long process in the region to deal with new loads and how customers are impacted. How fair that is, I don't know at this time. We will be very involved in that process. But what I do know is that if you live in Heppner, or if you live in Bandon, or if you live in Monument, or if you live in Christmas Valley, you are very concerned about what's going to happen to your electricity rates. The density of our systems causes our prices, or the cost of distributing electricity to be very high. Therefore, what we pay for power is extremely important. And right now, today, because we've had the opportunity to buy from Bonneville and get 100% of our needs met at cost-based rates, rural Oregonians have not been disadvantaged. We have very competitive rates right now. But that is because we buy from Bonneville. And so I just, we're asking the legislature in this resolution to just recognize the fact that there could be significant cost shift if this were to happen. You have many rural electricity customers who are very concerned about that possibility, and they would like very much for the legislature to recognize this issue and speak to it. And SJR 12 simply gives the legislature an opportunity to say, yeah, we have some concerns. We don't want to see cost shift onto other customers. We'd like to see all electricity customers in this state be treated fairly. If there is a change in the largest electric utility in this state serving 730,000 customers. My biggest utility serves 27,000 customers. I mean, you know, you don't compete very well when you serve 27,000 customers with that. So a lot of people have said, it's just a resolution. What are you bothering for? Why do you care? Forget it. Well, you know what? The people at a monument don't want me to forget it, and they don't want you to forget them. They want this legislative body to recognize that this could be a huge issue for them in terms of the costs that they pay for their electricity. It is very hard to live in some parts of rural Oregon, as I know you all know. That is nothing new. And we just simply don't want it to be any harder than it has to be. And if there's fairness to all electricity customers in the state, then we can prevent some of that from happening, possibly. So again, I really appreciate the fact that you've let me bring this back up. I know it's just a resolution. I know that it doesn't hold the force of law. And it's really not intended to. There will be a regional process. It is not intended to tie Portland's hands or anybody else's hands in terms of contract language. This is a concept. But it is an opportunity, again, for the legislature to speak to rural Oregonians and say, yes, we understand you have concerns. We understand this could have an economic impact on your small communities. And yes, we don't want that to happen. If at all possible, we don't want that to happen. So I ask for your support of SJR 12 so that I can take that message back to all the rural electric co-op customers in the state and assure them that the legislature did recognize this was an issue to be reckoned with and did speak on their behalf. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Sandy, I'm really happy to support the resolution, but, you know, taking this back to rural Oregonians can also raise their expectations that the rates are going to somehow be protected. And I can assure you that if some of this takes place, their rates are going to go up because of preference power. And so I'm happy to support it, but I think it's very easy to get out of. If you're the big city, you can say, look, I made every effort. We really tried, but because of yada, 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 this is the end result. And so happy to do it, but I think in fairness to the people that you are talking to, you need to explain to them that that doesn't have any guarantee. Don't raise their expectations that their rates won't go up if that purchase goes through.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, I couldn't agree with you more. We do have a monthly communication with our members, as you know, Ruralite, and there will probably be many articles in there if this happens to move forward. And we will work at a regional level very hard. We have many representatives that will work very hard on our behalf to deal with a potential cost shift issue. But you're absolutely right. There are not very many ways at the state level to address this because this preference is a federal issue. So, frankly, this was the best we could do. Thank you.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment that's totally insignificant, unimportant, and irrelevant. But I want to make it anyway. Sandy mentioned rural electricity, public power coming to Bandon. Now, that's especially important to me since I grew up in Bandon. And my dad, Rudy, was mayor of Bandon from the time I was in the 6th grade through the 12th grade, and one of his proudest accomplishments was he brought public power to Bandon, Oregon, and it's still in that fair city to this day. So I've heard a lot about public power growing up, and so these issues are of particular interest to me. So anyway, thank you for making me recall the past, Sandy. We'll go on from there. Like I said, unimportant, irrelevant, insignificant, but fun.
Thank you.
Further questions? All right. Thank you for your testimony. Professor Horse.
Mr. Chair, I move SJR 12 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves SJR 12 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Bass.
Aye.
Representative
Barnhart. Aye.
Representative
Close.
Aye.
She's a nine. Sorry.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Flores.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. And carrier for this bill? This resolution? Representative Backlund. All right. And that SJR then 12 then moves to the floor of the due pass recommendation, closes the work session on SJR 12. Open up a... colleagues, let's have a work session on possible introduction of speaker-approved bills. Colleagues, I don't know how to explain this except... we have probably the most optimistic lobbyist at this point asking us for a bill introduction. But on the other hand, you can also look at it from the pessimistic view that to move this on forward means that we're going to be here a few extra days.
No way.
But just as a quick highlight, in fact, John DiLorenzo, can you just come forward and just give us a very brief reason why we're even considering this right now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, John DiLorenzo, I'm an attorney with Davis Wright Tremaine. This is on behalf of my client, Student Loan Services, a finance corporation. The company is a nonprofit. It purchases student loan portfolios from banks, provides them additional money so they can make student loans at low interest rates. We had an amendment in the bond bill that would have allowed the association to become an issuer of private activity bonds, thereby lowering the amount that it pays, thereby lowering the interest rate that would be charged for student loans. This is a very big organization in the state of Washington. They have over $500 million out on student loans. They want to be able to provide the same services in Oregon. The amendment was lost on the cutting room floor during budget discussions. The Ways and Means Committee had authorized the bill yesterday to take care of this problem. Unfortunately, the Joint Committee did not meet yesterday, and so the Senate adjourned without being able to take any action on the bill. Just in case the Senate comes back, we'd just like to be postured. And we would appreciate your indulgence.
Thank you, Mr. DiLorenzo. And we have a motion, please.
Mr. Chair, I move LC Draft 3827 be introduced as a committee bill.
President Flores moves LC Draft 3827 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so ordered.
Thank you very much.
And it closes that work session. And it'll be interesting to see what that final bill number is, because I have a feeling that'll be the last bill number that gets introduced in this. Open up a work session on SJR 13. And let's see. Yeah, Craig Campbell, you want to come forward and explain SJR 13?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell from the Governor's Office. SJR 13 would put policing into the current constitutional definition of those expenditures that can be made as a result of taxes that currently go to what is referred to as the highway fund. This would allow us to use those funds that are raised for highway funds to be used for state police as they were prior to 1980. And although we had some amendments, it would be very foolish at this point in time for us to recommend those amendments be put into place. And so we are going to ask that, with the committee's indulgence, to move the bill to the floor, and hopefully so that we can have an election before the people. to ask them to put the state police back into the highway fund.
Thank you. Appreciate that testimony. Any questions, Mr. Campbell? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, sir. Didn't we vote on an issue like this recently?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, this issue was up, I believe, in 1999. There is I don't know how similar the wording was, but the intent was the same. The difference is that we have people who are interested in pursuing this very actively from a campaign standpoint when it does come up for an election. And it was also in the midst of a vast number of other ballot measures. So, of course, it suffered with the vote no on everything sentiment that occurred during that election cycle.
And to clarify, the actual election was in 2000.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Well, and he answered my other question, too, which is what makes you think this one will do better? And I think he answered that.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Further, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really do want to support the Oregon State Police. But in my district, this was soundly defeated. How do I go back to my constituents who said no, 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 and say, well, you said no, but I'm going to say yes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the one argument I could make that you could use is up till now the reductions that have occurred in state police have happened over time where those who have retired or those who have moved to other employment, their positions have not been refilled. And as a result, the number of troopers has gone down. We haven't seen layoffs up until now. And what we've seen recently as a result of the budget shortfall that we've seen, that the general fund, which is where the state police currently is a very dangerous place for state police to be because they become so susceptible. We actually had to lay off troopers this time, and I believe that was felt much more than it had been in the past. So whereas before, I think the public had not really seen an outcry where they had seen officers having to clean out their lockers, this time we did have to see that, and hopefully that will make them want to give them a more stable and dedicated funding source.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair, a comment. I believe that public safety is at the top of the list. If you just ask anybody what's the most important thing to you, they're just going to come in right there with public safety. But I have a hard time. If you were here asking me to put before the voters again, would you please reconsider? I would be happy to do that. But it's very, very difficult to go against the will of the voters.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Campbell, in the staff summary, it talks about the ballot measure in 1979. It was a referral for the state parks, and that removed the police from the constitutional dedication and the highway fund. Do you think that that was widely known by the people when they voted, that that's what they were doing, was removing the police from it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, I actually don't know. I was a bit younger then. Probably wasn't paying a lot of attention since I don't think I was voting age then. I do know that the intent was that if you move state police to the general fund, the idea was that the general fund would be a much more stable environment for them where the legislature would be able to enhance the state police more effectively. Unfortunately, history has shown us just the opposite. So I can't tell you what was in the mind of the voters when they chose to move them out. They also moved parks out at the same time. So I wish I could answer the question more directly than that. Unfortunately, I can't.
I would just say, Mr. Chair, I do remember voting on that, and I had no idea that that was in there, and I would guess that many people did not know that that was in that bill, that ballot measure. So for that reason alone, I think it would be worth an additional step.
Further questions? Representative Backlund?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's worth the comment. Statistics can be helpful. Having been an old baseball coach, I appreciate statistics. But in 1980, when this measure was passed, I do believe we had 665 state police highway troopers, and currently we have 329. And obviously that's all happened since 1980. So I think there's a good case to be made for finding a funding source for the state police. And so I'm going to support this.
Anything further? Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the highway fund used for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moss Anderson, currently it is used for repair, maintenance, and preservation and modernization of the state's cities and highway. I'm sorry, the state's streets, roads, and highways. If I remember correctly, or maybe somebody from ODOT who can I used to represent somebody who made sure I knew that, and that was 8 months ago. I lose a lot of that information quickly. But yeah, I think that's
based on that. It's in the bill. Public highways, roads, streets, and roadside rest areas. And it is construction, reconstruction, improvement, repair, maintenance, and operation of those.
So it's close.
So. Further questions? All right. Thank you for testimony.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Joint Resolution 13 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
President Flores moves Senate Joint Resolution 13 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am very reluctantly going to be a no, only because the voters have been turning down our gas tax increases and still wanting to have their roads and highways repaired, and because it was soundly defeated 70-30 in my district, I will be a no.
Further discussion? All right. Just a couple of comments here, and also a recognition, because we had not been able to hear this, to have any amendments taken care of by now. There is an issue with, first in paragraph 1 on line 7 of this bill. What this constitutional revision will do, or change will do, is allow any kind of policing of public highways to be financed through the this highway fund. And and one of the things we were trying to correct with amendments, if we were able to get this bill out earlier, was that it would be focused solely on state policing. But in this case now, it is certainly going to be left up to interpretation on what policing is going to mean. It could open it up for cities and counties and for other aspects. I mean, really kind of getting into the definition of what policing is. The second piece, part of the A and Gross version of SCR 13, which is what we're voting on paragraph 2 on the next page, shows that this will be held at what's called a special election throughout the state on the same date as the next primary election. So for all intents and purposes, this will be voted on in the next primary, even if, and one of the issues was, would we have an opportunity that that we might, if we had to come back in a special session, was there a way to correct this policing definition before it went out to the voters? Mm-hmm. And my assumption for the record is that we will not have that opportunity to come back for special session. However, even with those concerns, I do support this, and I support this for a couple of reasons. Representative Backlund alluded to the issue of really the way state police has been decimated over the last 6 years in particular. And I fault that not just on our poor economy that had some revenue problems, but I also fault our police superintendent, state police superintendent, who made an actual decision back in just before the 2001 session to not fill 75 state trooper positions, basically giving those up for the general fund other general fund priorities that then Governor Kitzhaber had. And I disagreed with that then. I think that put the state police in probably the worst position possible and has resulted in this kind of issue. We have to get more stable funding for state police. I'm looking forward to doing this in this way. I am still very concerned, though, on how this is going to open up to a lot of other cities and counties to be able to do the same kind of thing using this language. That's so close.
Could I ask you, does this money, the allocation of it, still go through the Ways and Means process if this were to pass?
Yes, it would. Yeah. So let's call the roll, please.
Representative Backlund.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Representative Torres.
Aye.
Representative Monis Anderson.
No.
Representative Berger.
No.
Chair Boyle.
Chair votes aye, and I will carry the bill, and that closes SJR 13. We'll close the work session on SJR 13, moves to the floor of the due pass recommendation. And colleagues, we are now having under a call to the House for the 42. We need to go on up there. We will be in recess until that's over and then come back down to finish these bills. We are in recess.
All members are present. Colleagues, this motion is to table Senate Bill 297. Again, it is not debatable. We will go to the voting system. All those in favor of the motion to table Senate Bill 297 will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Dalto, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Cruz? Votes no. Representative Gallegos? Votes aye. Senate Bill 2, the motion to lay Senate Bill 297 on the table, having failed to attain the required majority, is declared failed. We will continue with further discussion on the bill. Is there further discussion? Representative Williams? I'm sorry, colleagues, this is not on the bill. It is on the motion to adopt the conference committee report.
Whoops. Mr. Speaker, I believe the reader board. There we go. To the motion.
To the motion.
Colleagues, this bill went from the House. The Senate obviously did not agree with the amendments the House had made to this bill. It went to a conference committee. There was a considerable amount of effort on the part of the parties to figure out what could result out of that conference committee. There was no agreement. There was a sense that the changes that the House had made would have left a situation in some respects worse than the original version as it came through the process. There was an effort on the part of those proponents of the bill to offer at least some midpoint on how you would cover the issue, particularly of the period of time when a party was uninsured. That is still up to some obviously disagreement among the various parties. As a matter of public policy, I still think this bill accomplishes its fundamental purpose, which is to give some guidance on this issue and some finality on this issue. And while there is a certain amount of shifting of the burden from the property owner and from the previous, even the new property owner who may not have caused the pollution, onto an insurance company, I think I still remain convinced that between the parties, the insurers themselves are better able to sort out those details than to burden the landowner. I think ultimately this will result in less litigation, not more, and would be beneficial in these very large cleanup issues that are in front of us. For those reasons, colleagues, I will support the conference committee report and urge that you do the same.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the motion.
To the motion.
Colleagues, there are some very bright legal minds that have wrestled with the fine details of this. A good representative from Taggart and a good representative from North Eugene have looked at it with that scholarly legal perspective. I'd like to step back and take the viewpoint of a person not trained in the art of law, but in the art of common sense. We have a situation where multiple companies insure under an all sums policy a single piece of property over a long period of time. And then we have the challenge of when there is a loss, how does that loss get divided up among those companies? Are we simply going to have those companies refuse to pay, refuse to step forward and have a situation where the person who bought the policies, the entity that bought the policies, struggles through the courts for years without ever getting the core problem addressed? Or are we going to have a standard protocol, a protocol that facilitates a reasonably smooth way for those companies to divide up the responsibility? Colleagues, that's what this is. This is a legal protocol bill that says let's spend less resources fighting in court and let's spend more resources addressing the problem, whatever problem it was insured, that went away. So, on this vote, green is for common sense, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, to the motion.
To the motion.
Colleagues, I don't know how to tell you this, but it looks like to me that the lawyers have just gotten just almost every damn thing they've asked for in this past couple of hours here. And I'm getting really sick and tired of it. This is a piece of trash. It is unconstitutional what you're doing. Even some of the things that were done in committee, people had to come off of the committee because they felt so uneasy about what you were doing in this particular piece of legislation. Colleagues, I'll match you dollars to donuts. I've been there. I've cleaned up one of these sites. I brought the insurance companies in. We negotiated it through, and I got done with it. And I didn't have to have your help, thank you very much, with this kind of legislation. Because what this will do is it will drive out competition for this kind of insurance in the state of Oregon. This most recent activity on this bill and conference committee basically has turned the whole thing on its head and has it now where polluters don't pay. Polluters don't have to pay. There's an incentive to pollute. And you know what? When this committee ended up with a whole string of attorneys on it and the other members that weren't attorneys unwilling to attend or participate, basically what's happened is that we've created a law that says if you can't get it from your client, we're going to give you deep pockets, insurance companies, and you will get your fee. And it just makes me sick. This turns my stomach to see what we're doing with law in the state of Oregon. Thank you very much to the legal profession, and I use that term loosely.
Further discussion, Representative Kitts.
Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I will.
He does.
Thank you, good representative. There's the language on page 2, line 22. I'll give you a second.
Get the bill.
Is that language, am I to interpret that to mean that companies that polluted prior to 1971, that is, companies that polluted prior to 1971 and failed to obtain insurance are held harmless from paying their share of the pollution claim?
I want to make sure we're on the same page, Representative. You're saying page 2 and line 22?
No, sir.
If there's clarification, please.
I'm sorry. It would be page 2 on the be engrossed lines 22. I apologize, good representative. It's line 9 on the be engrossed. Page 2, line 9.
I'm looking at...
For clarification, I believe the representative is looking at the amendments.
I am.
Oh, okay. You said the engrossed bill, and I was looking at the bill.
I apologize.
Okay. All right, I have the conference committee amendments. Can you cite that?
Representative Kitts, if you want to restate your question now that he has the amendments before him.
It would be the page 2, line 22, I want to note that that is to be meant as companies that polluted prior to 1971 and failed to obtain insurance are held harmless from paying their share of the cost on a pollution claim.
Representative, I still don't think we're on the same page. I'm looking at the conference committee amendments to be engrossed Senate Bill 297. I turn to page 2, and I don't find that page.
Good Representative, maybe I'll just...
Let me ask Representative Kitts, can you identify by title the document you're referring to?
I am. It's the Conference Committee Amendments to be engrossed Senate Bill 297.
Is there a dash number on the upper right-hand corner?
Dash B30. If a good representative, I could read directly.
Just give me the page and line number again.
It says page 2.
Colleagues, let's stand at ease. Representative Ackerman, you want to come to Representative Kitt's desk? Let's get this worked out, then we can...
Well, I think, Mr. Speaker, in answer to your inquiry, I think he's looking at an LC. I don't think he's looking at the...
We'll stand at ease.
I can report, Mr. Speaker, that the Representative Kitts is looking at an LC draft. He's not looking at the Conference Committee amendments.
I apologize.
Good Representative Kitts.
I apologize, good Representative. I appear to have grabbed the right question, wrong version. Bear with me for 1 second.
Huh? I might know, yeah.
Representative Kitts, with your indulgence, maybe we can take Representative Anderson, who's next in the queue, and I'll come back to you.
Please.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was one of those who was replaced on the committee, but let me go back and just give you a little bit of history on this bill. Senate Bill 297 is a measure specifically designed to influence the outcome of a few pollution cut cases that are already at the Court of Appeals. The contents of Senate Bill 297 were in a House bill that died in the House Business Committee. Some of the provisions of that legislation, which died in the House committee, were gutted and stuffed into Senate Bill 297. The House Judiciary Committee amended Senate Bill 297 to make it a little bit more fair. While the deep pocket theory was still a main factor in the measure, at least the polluters were required to pay their fair share of the costs for periods of time the polluting industries did not carry insurance. The conference committee report in front of you today strips that fairness doctrine from the measure, and due to a cleverly written amendment, this measure allows those who polluted to shift the cleanup costs to those who will later pay for insurance. There is no free lunch. Ratepayers pay the premiums. Ratepayers pay those premiums so that claims can be paid. Do you all understand the ramifications of adopting this conference committee report? I'd like to make 6 different points about this report. Number 1, this measure is poorly written. Just read the section that defines uninsured. After 30 amendments, it's still clear that additional work should be done on this bill. 2, major pollution cases are being heard in the Court of Appeals at this time. This bill is an unabashed effort to affect the outcome of those cases. Only in cases of judicial abuse and injustice should the legislature decide the outcome of cases already before the appellate courts. 3, no other state has written this legislation into law. Several states, like Oregon, are presently seeing in their courts the decisions for these types of cases. 4, this particular bill is written for the benefit of a few companies who polluted but evidently neglected to buy environmental insurance during crucial time periods and became liable for their own costs. This measure allows them to shift those costs to the ratepayers of insurance companies. 5, the place for adjudication of major issues of this magnitude is in a court where all the facts can be clearly determined and a just decision rendered. I remember in my days in the city of Grants Pass when we had a condemnation, we didn't ask the people to go off in the field and figure out some equal way to handle each other. We put it in the court. The judge made the decision. Sixth and finally, presently without any change in the law, Oregon judges can make decisions on whether the facts of a case dictate a joint and several basis, or all sums, or a pro rata basis. This bill makes that determination for the court without the facts of cases being the determinant factor. In closing, this bill will not make insurance harder to get. In closing, colleagues, this bill will make insurance harder to get for Oregon businesses. This bill will not make insurance less costly for Oregon businesses. And finally, this bill will benefit a few well-off corporations at the expense of others. This is not what we came to Salem to do. I hope you will reject the conference committee report on Senate Bill 297.
Further discussion, Representative Greenlake.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the motion.
To the motion.
You are hearing a bit of nonsense about what this bill is really about. This is an important bill to my district. The Superfund site is in my district, and we need to get that Superfund cleaned up, and we need to make sure the people who are responsible for polluting pay. This will not make insurance any harder to get. The fact is that these companies have not provided this sort of insurance for pollution claims for more than a decade. This is about settling which insurance company and which company is liable for coverage that they sold in the 80s and early 90s. And the question isn't about whether polluters are going to get out from paying. The question is it okay to make insurance companies that sold this coverage, one, admit that they had sold the policy, the lost policy problem, and B, be responsible for defending against these claims? Once an insurance company is responsible for defending against these claims, there's no problem with then going after anybody else who covered those, who provided that insurance, and any companies for any time that they were uncovered for the pollution. This is the typical story of insurance companies starting by saying no. And then when you ask them again, they say no again. You've all had that experience. You've all had an automotive claim or a medical claim or some other claim, and you know the first answer is no. It's only when you enforce the policies that they sold that you get to be covered for the insurance you paid for. This is only about making the insurance industry that sold coverage for pollution exposure pay on in the terms of the policies that they sold. Let's not be fooled by what this is about. We need to get that Superfund site cleaned up, and we need to make sure the insurance companies that sold insurance to corporations that included coverage for pollution liability pay for the claims that they sold coverage for.
Further discussion, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Some comments have been made in the debate about how the bill came to this chamber in the form it's in now, and I just wanted to try to clarify that. This bill came up late in the proceedings of the House Judiciary Committee, and we made an attempt to strike a fair balance between the concerns of landowners who need to get assistance from their insurers to clean up sites that need to be cleaned up, but make sure that we were being fair to the insurers, especially with respect to periods in which the landowner did not purchase insurance. It turned out that the language that was adopted in our House Judiciary Committee did not achieve the intended results, and a conference committee was formed in order to deal with that reality. What the conference committee focused on is the concern about how you allocate responsibility between years in which the landowner had insurance and when it did not, and the concern that before there was any awareness of environmental liabilities, that neither landowner nor insurer had any awareness that this liability was out there. In fact, both parties, I think, are entirely innocent in this debate. It's a liability that comes out of left field with respect to everyone. The amendment that's in the conference report that you have before you, it uses 1971, and that is a date that is several decades back, so there's plenty of period of history in which to make a fair allocation between those years in which there is coverage and which there is not. And before that, there would have been no awareness on either part, either insurer or landowner, about the potential for liability under the environmental laws, since it was in the early 1970s that the major federal legislation on environmental cleanups was enacted. This is not a perfect solution. It's a difficult problem. It's one that we labored through in the House Judiciary Committee with some care. It's one that several of my colleagues on the committee labored through on the conference committee. I think it's a fair compromise of the competing interests, and I would urge you to support this motion.
Further discussion, Representative Miller. All right, there's no one else remaining in the queue. Representative Ackerman, do you wish to close?
Yes, briefly, Mr. Speaker, to meet some of the arguments. First, as to whether the bill is poorly written, I think we acknowledge that defining terms in a legislative environment.
Let's reopen the House Committee on Rules and Public Affairs, and let's open up a work session on Senate Bill 927. And you want to come forward and explain the bill?
Good afternoon. Dennis Mollihill, Washington County. First of all, thank you for the courtesy of hearing this. Senate Bill 927 corrects House Bill 3171 of the 01 session. That bill allowed counties to approve accessory farm dwellings for farm workers in EFU zones. Unfortunately, Washington and Lane County, which are marginal land counties, were left out of that listing. So this is a correction for a bill in 01. And 927 corrects that. And its original form in this legislative session, it was House Bill 2607. It passed the House floor 56-1. And then it got resurrected when it got in trouble over on the Senate side with committees closing. Turned it into 927, and that passed the Senate 26-0. If you have any questions, there are a myriad of land use planners from various and sundry entities that would be happy to take you into the arcane natures of this business.
I'd be very surprised if anybody else comes forward. But Representative Barnhart?
Would you repeat the other bill number, please?
2607.
Thank you.
All right. Further discussion? Further questions? All right. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Flores?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 927 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 927 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative
Barnhart? Aye.
Representative Close?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Monsanders?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Chair Doyle? Chair votes aye. We have a carrier for this, please.
Lane County?
Yeah,
thank you. Right.
Representative Barnhart will be the carrier. And Senate Bill 927 moves the floor of the due pass recommendation. And that closes the work session, Senate Bill 927. Let's venture in with open work session on Senate Bill 737. And
Chair Chairman Doyle, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dan Malin, the manager of the Oregon State Police Sex Offender Registration Unit. I'm here to provide information in support of this bill. This bill basically has three pieces to it. It requires agencies that supervise convicted sex offenders to register their clients. Under current law, an offender may be registered by the supervising agency, or that agency may have the offender report to a law enforcement agency for the purpose of registration. This bill will require the supervising agency to register the offender, and we're talking about 4,500 offenders who are on supervision in the state of Oregon right now. The second piece to the legislation deals with the registration of offenders with each job change and school change. This is key to a federal law which is called the Campus Sex Crimes Prevention Act. It requires states, the federal law requires states to register offenders at institutions of higher education so that the campus communities can have information about offenders who are on those campuses. It also ties up $1.2 million in federal burn grant funds to that purpose. If this bill doesn't pass, basically we lose that money for the next biennium. The third piece to it is that Oregon State Police will develop a rule to have offenders provide documentation to prove their change of residence with a change of address registration, an administrative rule. And I'm free to answer any questions that you might have on this bill.
All right. Questions, Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're taking this job away from the Oregon State Police. You're giving it to community corrections, and that is parole and probation primarily. Is that correct?
Chair Doyle, Representative Close, right now there are approximately 10,600 registered sex offenders in the state, only 4,500 of which are on supervision. Some of those offenders who are on supervision are registered by their supervising agency, many are not. It's true that it would shift the burden of registering these offenders to those supervising agencies, and there is some opposition to that on the part of community corrections agencies. It would alleviate Oregon State Police from some of these registrations, as we still do 61% of the registrations in the state. The answer to your question is yes.
Follow up? Thank you, Mr. Chair. My county parole and probation estimates this will cost them an extra $120,000 for the increased paperwork. They're not happy about this. This $1.2 million that you spoke of, to my knowledge, has not been transferred to the counties. So wouldn't this be an unfunded mandate?
Chair Doyle, Representative Close, if you look at the breakdown of the burn grant funding, it's spread out across a number of counties, a number of sexual abuse and domestic abuse task forces, agencies in the criminal justice system that deal with sex crimes and domestic violence crimes. So while one county may or may not be a part of that funding, the funding does touch a number of agencies throughout the state.
But what I'm asking you is specifically, what about my Linn County probation and parole people? It may go to task forces, but they're the ones doing the work, correct?
They would, Chair Doyle, Representative Close, they would be doing the registrations, that's true, and they would not be getting any more money to do those registrations. Additionally, if you look at it from the federal law perspective, the federal government now requires the states to increase the number of registrations that they do, but it also does not increase the amount of law enforcement grant funding that it provides. It refers to the same grant that it's been using for a number of years. So not only is it an unfunded mandate to your county, it's an unfunded mandate to the state as well.
Additional questions?
Chair, follow up?
Go. Okay.
I guess I just need clarification on, I mean, if it's a difference having an unfunded mandate to the state versus an unfunded, we're required by law to look at unfunded mandates to local entities differently. My assumption was Senate Bill 737 did not come out of the Senate on a supermajority vote as an unfunded mandate. Is that correct?
Chair Doyle, I think it was a unanimous vote just this week in the Senate when it passed. I believe it was. I don't remember any no votes.
Okay. Just to clarify, the fiscal summary suggests that the bill does not affect local government service levels or shared revenue sufficient to trigger Section 15, Article 11 of the Oregon Constitution. So if there's no further questions, we are under a call again.
I would like to reserve the right to ask one additional question.
All right, then we're going to go in recess. Thank you.
All members are present, those of the opinion that the conference committee report on Senate Bill 297, recall this is usually a voice vote with the call, will go to the voting system, so all those of the opinion that the conference committee report on Senate Bill 297 should be adopted will vote aye, those opposed no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Farr, for what purpose do you wish to be recognized?
Change my vote from no to yes.
Farr changes to aye. Representative Cruz, how do you vote? Votes no. Representative Jensen votes aye. Representative Gallegos is aye. Senate Bill 297, having received a constitutional majority, is declared. I'm sorry. The motion to adopt the conference committee report on Senate Bill 297, having received the required majority, is declared adopted. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. I move the House repass Senate Bill 297.
Representative Ackerman moves the House repass Senate Bill 297. To your motion.
Mr. Speaker, my comments have already been made. I urge passage of the bill.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Ackerman, do you wish to close?
I just did. Thank you.
Those of the opinion that Senate Bill 297 should be repassed will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Tomei, how do you vote? Representative Cruz votes no. Representative Nolan. Representative Nolan, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Tomei? Votes aye. Thank you. Representative Jensen votes aye. Representative Jensen votes aye. Representative Close votes no. Senate Bill 297, having received a constitutional majority, is declared repassed. Rules Committee will be excused to return to the hearing room until the next call. Colleagues, we intend to continue on the floor until we finish business. Pizza will be coming. We'll let you know when that's arrived, and we'll offer that off the floor. We'll let you know when that comes. But otherwise, we will continue to do business until we are concluded for the day. Representative Dalto.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move adoption of the committee report on Senate Bill 915.
Representative Dalton moves adoption of the committee report on Senate Bill 915. To your motion, and colleagues, if I could ask for quiet on the floor, please, so we can hear the carrier.
Colleagues, Senate Bill 915 is a simple bill which corrects an oversight in our land use system that presently does not allow law enforcement to site within the exclusive farm use zone. In other words, under Oregon law, elected sheriffs in each one of your counties.
To resume the House Committee on Rules and Public Affairs and resume the work session on Senate Bill 737. And Dan Mallon, come forward again. And Craig Campbell, can you come forward as well? I think he might help us with a couple of questions that came from Representative Close.
We're on the last two, huh?
Let's see, I think you had a follow-up, didn't you?
Okay.
So yes, follow-up to Representative Close.
Thank you very much. This tracking now requires changes in employment. And I'm told that sex offenders change jobs frequently, so I would like you to tell me how often is the average that they change jobs weekly, monthly, because I'm worried about the amount of paperwork that now will be generated.
Chairman Doyle, Representative Close, thank you for the question. It is a population that does change jobs frequently, and often what occurs is when they obtain employment, and then the community, the people around the business, whatever the case might be, learn that the person is a registered sex offender, it creates difficulty for the businesses or the person individually, and they end up moving to another job. We estimated, if I can go back to the Campus Sex Crimes Prevention Act, it only required registrations at institutions of higher education. This bill is a little bit more broad. It actually requires registrations for all job and school changes. And there were some concerns about that. We estimated that the way this bill is currently worded, it will result in an estimated increase of 800 to 1,000 registrations per year. Out of the over 18,000 registrations that are processed every year, that's not that many, but it's still an increase. So I don't know if that answers your question.
If I could go back to the question, though, about the increase in the workload on the part of the community corrections agencies. If we talk about Linn County specifically, some of these offenders who are on supervision are being registered at the Linn County Sheriff's Office. Some of them are being registered at the Albany Police Department, Sweet Home Police Department, Lebanon Police Department. They're not all being registered at the Oregon State Police, and there's this idea that it's an Oregon State Police registration program, but that's not the case. Many of the cities in Linn County and cities across the state, the city police departments are very active with registration. So even though the community corrections agencies would take on an increased burden, there would be a shifting of the burden not just from Oregon State Police, but from those police departments and sheriff's offices as well.
Follow-up? But isn't it the community corrections people that now take on this responsibility, and isn't that primarily probation and parole?
Chair Doyle, Representative Close, that's correct. I think the intent of the original bill, having had discussions with Senator Minnis on this bill, was these community corrections agencies have contact standards. They're in contact with these offenders at certain frequencies anyway, in some cases weekly, maybe monthly, maybe more than that. So the idea was, since they're sitting down and meeting with these individuals anyway, I think the intent was that it wouldn't be that much more difficult to spend 5 minutes to fill out a form. The forms are provided by the Oregon State Police, so as far as the paperwork is concerned, it's not a paperwork burden, it's a filling out the form burden, and frankly, it takes about 5 minutes to fill out a form.
Well, I would just say that my Linn County people tell me it will cost them $120,000 to implement this, and you multiply that by 36 counties, and you're up to $4 million, which is a whole lot more than the $1.2 million that the feds are offering. It's four times as high.
Mr. Campbell, can you respond?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Close. Apparently, the community corrections directors yesterday completed a fiscal, and the $120,000 is a biennial statewide number, so it doesn't apply specifically to Linn County. So they're expecting that their costs will increase by about $60,000 a year statewide. So the person who provided you the information from Linn County may have been confused about the number. At least that's what I'm being told by the community corrections folks who are here.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Berger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, I want to understand your bill in the context of the problem in Oregon. You said there are 10,000 sex offenders in Oregon, but this bill really only applies to the 4,500 that are supervised.
Chairman Doyle, Representative Berger, the part of the bill that deals with supervising agencies registering their clients deals with the 4,500. The other piece of the bill that deals with offenders having registrants having to register with each job and school change, that applies to all offenders.
All of them. I have to just make a comment, and it is a little bit beyond your bill, but I think your bill is a part of the problem. I'm very concerned about very young people who are getting a sex offender label put on them for life, and having to register and being, they've made one mistake and it's made them feel that they are so penalized. And every time they move from school, every time they move from employment, which your bill covers, it is not helping to build self-esteem and to have a more healthy emotional life for that young person who needs to have that, so that they don't keep being an offender. And so having said that, there is another bill, and I was hoping that it was your bill, but it was not. I am concerned about the work being shifted to the counties, but if it's a part of what is mandated, then you're just trying to get them to be sure that they're registered. I do hope, and I say this sincerely, I really hope that you'll take a look, though, at exactly what you're doing to some people. We want the hardened people, the people that are really sick, but not people that have just made one mistake.
All right. Further questions? All right. Thank you for your testimony. And colleagues, we're on another call, but I think we can just get this vote done quickly and then go from there. So let's call the roll. We need a motion first.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 737 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 737 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Close.
Mr. Chair, I will be a no because this bill is broader than the federal law requires. It only requires higher education, and I think that this goes farther. I think it will cost our counties. I think they're strapped already, and so I will regretfully be a no.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I'm going to vote for this measure. The issues that Representative Verger raises are important issues, and we need to look at them carefully over time, who we actually register. But the issue of making sure that we know where people are working and where they're going to school, I'm convinced is an important one for those who we ought to be registering. And so I'm a yes.
Okay, thank you. Other discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative
Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative
Close?
Votes no.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative
Bonasanders?
Aye.
Representative Verger?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. And carrier for this bill? All right, I'll carry it then. And Senate Bill 737 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I close the work session, and we are in recess.
Okay.
All members are present. Those of the opinion the bill should pass, the vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Jensen, how do you vote? Jensen votes aye. Representative Johnson, how do you vote? Johnson votes aye. Representative Berger, how do you vote? Berger votes aye. Representative Hunt? Hunt votes no. Representative Greenlick votes no. Representative Backlund votes aye. Representative Williams votes aye. Representative Cromwell, how do you vote? Representative Nelson, for what purpose do you rise?